No, this is Joe Walsh. I just before we get into all the speakers, I just want to say a few quick words before they get going. And the first thing I want to say is, like, what is open knowledge? These forums are on that, and you might be wondering what exactly it is. And it has basically three aspects. One is that it's legally open, like you're allowed to get information and data. So take an example that came up last time. US zip codes in the States, you're allowed to have them, it's legal to get them, do stuff with them. And here in the UK, the postcodes are under Crown copyright, so you're not allowed to go and do stuff with them without getting permission. The second part of open is social, right? That you're allowed to get data. That's right, you can get data. Not only you're allowed to, but that you're able to download it, find it, or whatever. And another example that came up was a database of MPs' voting records. It's nothing illegal about disseminating that, but it just might not exist. If someone has it, they might not be giving it to you. You might have to pay them, or you might have to do all kinds of stuff to get it. But as we now know, Public WIP, which is a website set up by someone who hasn't yet arrived here, does exactly that. It provides a database of MPs' voting records, and it's covered by no rights, and you can get it now. Finally, technological. Once you've got data, you've got to be able to use it and read it and do stuff with it. And if data is locked up in some proprietary format, or it's encrypted in some weird way, then you're not going to be able to actually use any data you've got. So there's these three strands to what we mean by open data and open geodata. And I think you can kind of see examples of all of those cases applying to geodata. Now you know what open knowledge is. I'm just going to say one quick word about what this forum fundamentally, I think, is about, with an example. And it's an example given to me by a friend of mine who's actually an environmentalist and doesn't have much interest in geodata or much interest in programming or anything like that. And the example was that he really cares about environment, so he buys a detergent called Ecover, I haven't really used. And this is great, it's really good for the environment, but it comes in these quite small plastic bottles. Right. Plastic bottles aren't that great for the environment, which kind of upsets him. So one of the things, Ecover are aware of this. So what they've done is a deal where you can go and refill these plastic bottles somewhere, right? So that you really can feel good that you're not creating loads of stuff going into some waste dump. But the issue is, where is your local refilling station for your Ecover bottle, right? I mean, he actually didn't find out. He lives near Spitalfields, and it took him quite a long time wandering around and asking, going to various places that he bought it from, before he actually found a refilling station. And wouldn't it be great if he could have just gone to some website, typed in his postcode, and bam, there it was, 200 yards down the street, in that kind of back corner place, whatever it was, there was his refilling station. But what would you need if you were just some kind of hacker who cared about the environment and wanted to build this site? Right? You'd need place data, you'd need the information about the Ecover refilling stations, and you'd need postcode data. Pretty much at least two out of those two things are kind of locked up right now. And without access, if someone has to go and ask permission and spend time and do all kinds of stuff, that is not going to happen. And it's these kind of micro, up to even quite big things that I really want to see enabled by more open geodata. So those kind of public service, non-commercial, all the way up can be enabled. So anyways, every day, my message is here, we are affected by whether information is open or closed. We just don't realize it. And be that among policymakers, the public, or other communities, people just don't care. They don't realize what could be possible. And we now in several areas, particularly this one, we start to see activities that demonstrate what would be possible if we had that open geodata. And I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg, and I want to see a lot more of that. I want to see it be enabled by the people who have this data, who take a more constructive approach to that data and to what can be done with it. Anyway, thank you, and we're going to go straight into our first speaker, who's Steve Tosin, and his man, barring technical hitches. No, thank you.
Am I just going to be in the way of this?
No, we calculated it very fast. We're just building tension. We can move along. Well, would you mind turning off the sound of the light? That would be very kind, thank you.
Okay, so hello, my name's Stephen Case. I'm at Universal College London and I'm just about to finish a physics degree. And OpenStreetMap is something I started a little while ago. So there's my address. OpenStreetMap's a website I started a little while ago that does open geodata type things. Just want to say that logo's really cool, isn't it? And thank you to Matt for doing it. Okay, so I've done these slides fairly quickly, so I apologise if there's mistakes, but I'll try and skip through them. So, why do OpenStreetMap? Why do Open Geodata? Because it's not free. It's as simple as that in the UK. We have the spectrum of intellectual freedoms we can apply to geodata. In the US, it's effectively down this end, PD standing for public domain, where the US government has pushed away their census data for free. And then in the UK, we're all the way, appropriately maybe, at the right end of the spectrum, which is just copyright. And then in between there somewhere is Creative Commons, which is what CC stands for, and other licenses that allow you to do stuff with the data, but don't necessarily give you total freedoms or some mixture of that. And the other reason you want to do it is because people actually want it. They don't necessarily need the OS's extremely highly detailed data where you know where a bay window is for the nearest couple of centimetres or things like that. But data at 5 or 10 metre resolution, not even down to 1 metre resolution, becomes very useful to people for all sorts of applications. Another reason why you don't need high accuracy data is because most people don't have the accuracy on the ground to even make use of it. If your commercial GPS unit doesn't do better accuracy than the data you have, then it's a little bit pointless. There's been an explosion of uses in the US due to the freedom of their data that you don't see so much of here because of the restrictions on the licenses of it. And then, at the very least, even if it was free, it's kind of the thing you would expect to have appeared in the United States but hasn't already, this kind of collaborative environment for putting map data together, possibly because you need an awful lot of data storage and stuff like that. But it's an idea whose time has come and the technology is there. So, who would like OpenStreetMap? Hopefully the public, the British public specifically, more generally possibly the European public, anyone whose government has given effective monopoly on geodata to some entity. Because competition is good, most people don't think this, because it will any kind of competition with the OS and other people will bring down the price of mapping products, and so it's good for you as a consumer. That will mean specifically things like cheaper GPS routing units for your car, so the kind of things you put on your dashboard that tell you how to get from Bristol to Regent's Park or wherever you're going today. And cheaper paper maps. And also give you the utility to do what you like with your maps, which you can't effectively with any map in the UK at the moment. Another group of people will be in general interested parties, but not necessarily academics, but them too, because they have an awful lot of dealing with the OS. Speaking to one of the things I do part-time is work in the Bartlett and the geography departments at UCL. And they're not entirely happy at sort of drinking the OS Kool-Aid. They love their data. The OS gives all sorts of data to geographic departments to do what they like with, but once they try and actually do anything with it beyond pure research, it's kind of a no-go area. So academics do actually want it because there's no tie to the data, no tie to the license, sorry. Interested third parties traditionally in the country have just stolen data. That means going to streetmap.co.uk, copying a picture and then drawing stuff on top of it, photocopying it, putting it in the church hall, whatever. As a picture, it's not particularly useful, so we're not just talking about producing pictures that you can print out and then find out where the Stanhope Centre is in relation to Hyde Park, but it's also vector data which is useful to computers so that the computer can actually route your directions for you. And also, the data might be slightly odd sentence bit here. The data might be more timely and accurate under certain circumstances than the data you have available for free at the moment. And I'll give an example of that in a few slides. So what is OpenStreetMap? It's open, and it's a street, and it's a map. I think that's what I'm going for here. So data under a free license, it's that. So the data is free, vector data is free, the tools are free. For some definition of free, that would be in the middle ground between totally public domain and totally copyrighted. The street does not just mean street maps. OpenStreetMap happens to be just a nice name, and we have a guy Nick, wherever he is, doing all sorts of stuff that is not necessarily urban data. So we're not just limited to that, although obviously lots of people live in urban areas. And it's not just lines, it's point of interest stuff like Baker Street Tube Station or a pub, and the associated metadata such as the name of a street, or whether it's one way, or whether it allows donkeys or people to walk down it, and stuff like that. And then a map, it's on your terms. So in OpenStreetMap as it stands, there's no enforced ontology because there's so many different people who want to do different types of mapping that it seems to me that enforcing an ontology to people for OpenStreetMap is a little bit of a nightmare, and so I've made it open, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. So how do you do OpenStreetMap? You have to collect the data, basically. And you need two types of data. The first is the physical location data, such as the latitude and longitude of the street and how it connects to other streets, where Baker Street Tube Station is, where a lake is, that kind of stuff. And then you need the metadata that's about, so the depth of the lake, the name of the street, whether it's one way, that kind of stuff. This just outlines a couple of ways of doing it. Location data, you can physically wander around with a GPS unit. So that might mean a commercial unit for 100 quid or something more serious with a cheap laptop. Plug it into the car, cigarette lighter, and drive around, or more serious stuff. The other way is analysis of satellite or aerial photography. So you buy or otherwise get some aerial data and draw on top of it where the streets are and where the roundabouts are and where Baker Street Station is and stuff like that. Then the metadata has to also be physically collected, so that means wandering around and literally looking at the street names, writing down this is Baker Street and I'm at certain latitude and longitude. Or it could be referenced from out of copyright maps, of which there are quite a few, because I believe there's someone here with maps 50 years old that have dropped out of copyright. And then there's just from memory. So the idea is if you went to a map of central London and you happen to know that a pub was on the other side of the road to where someone had put it or something like that, then from memory you could correct spelling mistakes or move them around. And we've done experiments to do this. Well, I've done the car bit anyway, the satellite data other people have been looking at. We hired a car for a weekend to do a back of the envelope calculation about how much it would be to drive around central London with two people, noting down metadata such as street names and also collecting the data, which we talked about some of the time, spend tons of time. So how OpenStreetMap, how does it look for the end user? It looks like that. That's the front page. If any of you have laptops, I think you probably look at it now. It's designed to be simple for a reason. It's designed to look like Google for a reason. It has the pretty logo and then different ways of searching for the data, which at the moment don't work because we're still working on metadata stuff, but you can go for latitude and longitude. And then a bunch of links at the bottom that link to a wiki to tell you all about the project. Once you choose latitude and longitude, you get a static image with a couple of simple tools to just move around it. This area happens to be Regent's Park. These grey dots are circles where either a car or walking around or cycling or something. Data's been collected. And then the black lines on top are vector data that's been laid on top to actually create the map out of a number of points. And then up the top right, you can log in or create an account, or you can edit the map. It's supposed to be some kind of blend of easy to use in Wikipedia and stuff like that. So if you log in and hit edit map, you get something that looks like this at the moment. You get a big Java applet that looks hopefully fairly similar to the image we just saw. You have a bunch of tools down the left-hand side. The simplest one is just view map, which views the map. Edit keys, we have a key value system, so you can associate key, such a key might be a name or accessible to pedestrians or some other metadata, and then the value of that metadata might be key, name, and then value, data street. And that is the ontology system that's fairly open. And then the idea is that you can create equivalences so that you could say key, motorway, value, yes, and that would be equivalent to accessible to cars, speed limit 70, and then other things like that. You can also upload GPX tracks. GPX tracks are just a simple file format that would allow you to share these actual points as you're walking around. This is someone wandering around with a GPS unit. So you can upload them and then view and then draw lines on top. And then in the applet itself, it looks fairly similar to just looking around the image, except it's got more wizzy buttons perhaps. And then you've got a bunch of tools up the right hand side where you can actually draw vectors on top. So the idea with this tab system here is lines, and then you put a bunch of nodes, say node there, node there, node there, node there, and then you connect the lines together to form line segments, and then you can connect the line segments together to form streets, and then you can work from there. So, this is why we're doing this, because it's probably illegal for me to even show you this map, technically. This is Regent's Park, and this is just a quick comparison to show you what our map looks like and some of the more subtle differences that you can tell. The first one is, it's possible to be more detailed, because if you look at this one, this is what's called the inner circle of Regent's Park, and it's the rose garden detail. And this is the complete path map of the rose gardens. It's not entirely clear that you would want a complete path map of the rose gardens, but should you want it, it's completely possible to do so. With no S-map, perhaps not. So that same circle is at a far lower detail. The other thing is, when I gave a similar talk to this in August or something, a while ago, this map hasn't changed since then. And if anyone knows Regent's Park, most of it's been dug up over the past 2 years. And this path no longer exists. And also this major section on this playfield here, the rugby fields here and here, has been cut off. So with local knowledge, it's possible to be more timely with your data and more accurate, possibly. The next section is how OpenStreetMap for interested parties. So what's available now? The XML-RPC interface. XML-RPC is just a way of two computers talking to each other over the internet. There's an open documented interface up on the wiki that allows you to write a piece of software to upload and download data from OpenStreetMap. There is also up there a free implementation of the software, the applet that we saw over here. That applet and all the source code and all of this HTML and all the images and so on is all in a subversion repository, and it's all free and you can go and look at it. The GPX tracks, it's possible to upload GPX tracks, download them again, download the points, put restrictions on them, so instead of just downloading someone walking around a part of Regent's Park, you could just specify an area for Regent's Park and then download all the points people have recorded within that. And then all of these changes are wikied. This has been possibly the most difficult part of this, and by far the most boring of writing OpenStreetMap. You want, in the same way that Wikipedia, if you go in and delete an article or deface it, and then someone else can come back and change it back, you want to be able to do that with OpenStreetMap, so that if someone moves Baker Street to Edinburgh, or they delete a major road or the M25, then it's possible for people to see that mistake and reverse it. And that happens. And that has to be able to happen across the keys associated with the street segments themselves, the way street segments are put together into streets. So it has to be across the board, which requires some planning and some writing software to make sure it all works. But it's very nice, and it means we get to keep all data. The other nice thing about making it wikied is, and also there's a login system with this, is that if anyone uploads any copyrighted data to OpenStreetMap and it's pointed out that we have copyright data, then it's possible to have a complete change history of where that came from and to be able to remove it so that hopefully we're not liable to be taken to court over copyright infringement. Then there's planned stuff, of which there's just as much as you can think of. There's plans to do integration of aerial and satellite data, not least because free Landsat data can be used to do the outlines of woods, rivers, and very big rivers, and other features that it's difficult to just wander around and walk around yourself and take the data. But of course could be extended down to higher resolution. Then PDF map downloads and Garmin maps. I don't have one myself, but I'm told that handheld Garmin GPS units, you can download maps of them and it will be useful to be able to do that. There's a standalone home use application, so instead of going to the website and using the applet or any other interface that comes up, you can use an application at your own computer that will talk to a GPS unit, and then you can edit the points at home and then only upload the differences to the OpenStreetMap server, which is what Nick's going to talk about in a minute. And then there's the idea of having a nice map server slash googly type static interface. And I'm guessing most of you have seen Google Maps, where you can drag around an image and it's all very pretty and fast. Right, so the where.
You want to, just if you can?
I've got two more slides. Almost done. London, for me, because I live here. A complete map I don't feel is required just yet. High use areas are more important. So what I mean by not required is we don't need to map every nook and cranny when not everyone's going to go and use every nook and cranny. To be useful to 80% of the people means having all the tube stations, major roads, and then stuff like that. We do not need to be geographically accurate with by and then go by kilometre per kilometre, but work down the road system is perhaps a better way of doing it. I think within a year we'll have 80% of Zone 1 if things go well. And then anywhere else, if anyone cares to map it, people have been uploading stuff from various parts of the country which are free to go and look at. How to help? Well, money is always good. Write some code, collect some data, those are obvious things. And then also partner on targeting specific mapping areas. Have quite a bit of interest. There was a Guardian article a while. I got a couple of emails from people who teach geography and want to get school groups involved with collecting local data. And then obviously there's cycling and walking groups who you hope will be interested. And anyone interested in saving money on geodata, this should be useful too. Thank you for listening.
Just one thing, anyone at the back? There are some seats at the front if anyone wants to move forward, just because I know there's some people stuck there. If anyone wants to come forward, there is a space. Do you have a question?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, one of all the patients.
I'll email it.
Steve, would you mind moving down just now because of the screen? Would that be okay? Would you mind just bringing it?
I'm going to stand up. I'm just going to move this.
Yes, the answer to that is everything to the sheets. No, the technical sheets, people giving these cards and coming to the website, at the end, there's going to be more information pointed to the way you can make
that.
Okay. Right, and
okay, thanks for giving me the opportunity to actually say how you can look at government and talk a little bit about this local government perspective of making maps available. Local government is this huge creator of geographic information, but also user of geographic information. We use it in asset management, service delivery and performance management. For example, for highway maintenance, government maintenance of green spaces, parks, play areas, service delivery to locate our services like mobile libraries and things like that. Performance management, how well do we actually serve the public, issues of waste management, are our building sites accessible? There's so many examples. It's always difficult to think about it when you're speaking publicly. 75% of all information is just linked to location and therefore it's geographic, either by access or by group reference. So that's why geographic information is of great importance in local governments. The information we produce and create in local government, we actually have the intellectual property rights of the information. But there are lots of statutes by which we have to make the information accessible. And one of the major recent ones is the Freedom of Information Act, which actually gives the right to access information. So you will find that a lot of the stuff, the OpenStreetMap, is actually already available on all sorts of websites when you look especially at local government websites. With e-government, there are actually quite a few requirements. There's a plan for national priority outcomes which we have to meet with local government to provide electronic services to the public. And GIS and GI is actually mentioned in a lot of the national priority outcome areas. One of the major ones is public access to corporate geographic information systems for map-based data presentation of property-related information, and that's access to planning applications, to school locations, to roadwork, showing where roadwork is actually happening. And we have to meet all of these targets by the end of 2015. So what I want to do now is give you some examples and tell you just through a few local government websites to give you actually an idea what type of information we are making available to the public so that we can access it. Just one from the home area that I'm coming from, the Network Council, we're one of the first websites which actually provided access to geographic information, and it's quite basic. It shows basic location where something is. But what's interesting at the moment is for the election, we are showing zoning information, and this map shows the wards, the electoral wards, and the polling districts and the polling stations. Now this information is still in the website, it shouldn't be, because I got instructed yesterday to take it off, because the polling stations on it are not accurate, and especially during the time of elections, people might check where their next polling station is. So that's a particular issue which you have with accessing the information. That is the information accurate, and what time will people rely on that information, and how do we keep it as quickly up to date as we can? Another example is Friends, which uses the access to map data, especially to find my nearest location. And there we have to search for postcode dates according to postcodes. The interesting thing about Friends is that they don't resource their own infrastructure within Brent. They have it outsourced, and Multimap is providing them with the service. So they send the data down to Multimap, and Multimap produces all the maps. So I give a very simple example here, just typing the postcode and ask for a child mind that's nearest to the location which I selected. And that comes with the map, shows the centroid of the postcode, and then the right-hand side shows all details about childminders, and then if I click on one of them, it links back to the information which Brent actually holds in their back of the system and gives me then more detailed information about the Brent's child information service, something which I selected. And that's the classic application which you find on more than 50% of all local government websites now. So that's the access to information which we have to compare with. Another example is Durham. Because Durham is special, there are no few examples of providing regional services. The problem we have with websites from different local authorities, they end at a boundary. You don't have seamless services. And if you happen to live just at the boundary between two local authorities and you want to find your nearest recycling point, one local government website might actually show it, the next one doesn't, and your nearest recycling point might actually be in the neighboring local authority. So what Durham has done is they provide web service for the whole of the county, gathering information from the individual districts. So it's much more regional in its approach. What I found interesting when I traced through the Durham County website, that they actually provide information which is not information which they produce within the local authorities. It shows all the location of ATM cash machines, which is not information the local authorities actually hold. And in Medway, we have a discussion about showing, should we show GP search rates, should we show post offices and so on. but we don't own the information, therefore we don't know how accurate the information is put on the website. We're working by the principle that we should only show the information which we actually own, and therefore we can guarantee the accuracy of it, instead of downloading it from another site. And if you don't have the direct link to get the direct link of the data down, it can very easily be outdated. Another example for one of the National Authority outcome areas is showing that in roadworks, especially emergency street works, and this is an example from Islington. And due to the street works going on at the moment, and something you cannot read in detail below, it's small, and actually says that the operator of the street works, which is happening there, is Transco, and they need an extension for the roadwork they're doing. So you can get all sorts of information. The start date of the roadwork, the end date of the roadwork. Today is the end date, so it flies down tomorrow and the roadwork should be finished. So that's really up-to-date, accurate information which you can now get through these local government websites. And then I also want to give a national example, which is actually Travelline. It's a project which is run through Transport Direct, which is funded through the Department for Transport. What they're trying to do is to get all the transport information from all local authorities together on the website, so you have a journey planner across the country going from A to B. And the interesting thing about this one is, because I'm German, I clicked on the German button, and I could type my information in German. So postcode time, postcode. Obviously, I still have to put the English details in, because it's only for England. So I tried it out. Thought our area wants to go from work to home, and I type in, you can type in locations or you can type in postcodes, and you get an itinerary of the journey, and then you can click on start map, and it gives you actually a map of the area to find out where the bus stop is and where the bus is actually going. The problem with this website is, again, accuracy of information. If you actually have local knowledge of the area, you know it doesn't always work. We know where the mistakes are. We know that there are location names in which are so historic that they don't exist anymore. And that there are some very dominant location names which are not even entered in there. And we know that some bus routes don't exist anymore in general. So that's an issue of data accuracy and information management to keep the data up to date. And that's really, I want to focus a little bit more on the issue for accessing information, about the policy side behind it. It's all well and good if you have the technology, but there's a much bigger issue about providing the information, keeping it up to date, maintaining it. So there's the issue of the accuracy of the information. You talked about earlier on, it doesn't matter if a road is filmed for many meters out. But if you give opening times about a nursery, or a library, and you show up and that library is closed, you're quite angry about that. It's also an issue about the currency, accuracy and currency. Is the library still at that location, or might it have to move? Is the library actually exactly there, or has someone not put it in very accurately? So these are issues which need to be dealt with. The other one is cost. There's quite a lot of cost involved in keeping data up to date. It's not only gathering the information once. How often do you run your street map again and drive it again to see if it's still up to date? And that's for us the biggest issue. We got funding through the government to put all of these initiatives into place. But who funds now? Who sustains the data which is sitting actually behind it? That costs a lot of money. And the other issue is that local authorities haven't engaged really in changing and focusing more on information as an asset to keep it up to date, to monitor. And the issue of data ownership, who owns the data? Because we as local authorities have a lot of our map data based on online survey, and therefore then it's a value-added product where you have to consider also the topic type of the online survey if you wanted to pass information. That's the volume of information. If you go to some local government websites, you find over 200 data layers you can choose. We basically give too much information, and we sometimes don't know how to present it, how to categorize it. It's so much. What does the public actually want? What information do you want to see? And that's often an issue as well. The investment into the infrastructure, most of us now have some sort of water mapping service, and otherwise we buy it into WaterMap or MapQuest or any of the other providers. So that's not such a big issue anymore, I would say. Data compatibility. That was a big issue for a London project, which was called CABI, where they tried to build a geographic information web service for central London. And everybody had their data stored in different formats. And it was difficult for them to pull all the different data sets together to produce a seamless data set, because they all gathered their data according to different protocols and different standards. And finally, I think there's a lack of understanding and funding for information. People don't understand how much it's actually involved keeping the information up to date. It's like if you buy a car and don't budget for paying for insurance and for the petrol you have to put in as well. One of the issues you find on a lot of websites now is that they actually try to protect themselves from liability for the accuracy of the information. And you will find all sorts of disclaimers on the website. We don't give liability for the accuracy of this information. And I think that's something you need to be watched out for if you want to reuse the information. How accurate is it? Can you rely your decision making on the information you actually see? So talk to us. Okay, I'm getting to the end soon. Yes? I talked a lot about accessibility, which is the right to access to information. I think a lot of it is available. The problem is really with the reuse of information, which comes into the public sector information directive, which gets embedded on the 1st of July, and which is the right to reuse information to encourage the development of value-added products. And I just want to give a few examples of problems with it. First of all, if you want to reuse information to actually fit for purpose, you find that the high-risk data which were collected for a specific purpose in mind for grant maintenance might not be fit for purpose for the public to see, civil, private or public or whatever. Who's responsible for the data content, for the accuracy and so on? Who owns the data? If you add value, who's the owner? We're working at the moment quite a lot with the supplier buyer model. Someone who supplies the data and buys it. But if you add value, can you still have that chain, that business model? And then the technical side of it is really that we need to provide web hosting services instead of just producing that. And that's a new infrastructure which is required for further investment and so on. So, final slide. What we are trying to promote through the AGI is actually a need for a GI strategy to address some of the issues, to make information more seamlessly available and to facilitate especially the reuse of information. We need to identify the key geographic information, standardize the processes and protocols for sharing information, coordinate legal and commercial compliance that we have one model for the country. Communicate the value of GI and raise awareness and understanding for geographic information management and seek commitment on governance and senior decision making. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've got several questions, but I'm going to keep that actually to ask you at the end. We're going to go straight in to the next talk, which is from Josh from Social Tapestry.
I'll introduce myself.
Do you need to
No. We can turn on the lights as well. I'm not going to project anything. And my name is Giles Lane. I'm the director of a creative studio. We're also a research organisation called Proboscis, and we run projects that cross disciplines and from the arts to technical, social science. It's also important to say I'm neither a geographer nor am I a technical person. My background is very much in the arts, and so I come to this not from a burning desire to solve technical issues, nor am I a geographer and deeply steeped in the values of geography. But I came to this because I've been involved in research to do with location-based mobile projects since about 1998, and was getting utterly fed up of the impoverished vision of the researchers in the universities and the researchers in industry, who basically were continually representing the idea that the future of location-based mobile telephony was tourist maps. And I was thinking, simple question, for how many weeks of the year are people tourists? 2 weeks. What about the other 50? What services are they thinking about? What social, cultural, economic, political services are these things going to provide for us? And frankly, no one had thought about it like that. So we devised a project called Urban Tapestries about 2 years ago. It was funded by the Arts Council and the Department of Trade and Industry and the Daniel Langlois Foundation in Montreal. And we partnered up with Hewlett-Packard Research Labs, who provided us with PDAs. And we collaborated with Orange, who provided us with mobile phones and network access. And we also worked with France Telecom's UK R&D group, who actually did some programming for us for the Symbian platform. Essentially, what we wanted to do is to kind of step aside and think away from the technology, but actually look at what is it important, why is everyone so energized about this? What is so important about geography and technology and the ability to annotate places? And our sort of intuition was that this is about what we call social knowledge. It's about actually people having voice, embedding their voice into the fabric of the city. And this is why we use the metaphor of tapestry and stitching and threads and this whole very, very tactile thing, something that we can all understand. We know that maps sometimes look like tapestries. So I wanted to talk today about, or think about, open geodata on two levels. So firstly, this idea of this sort of social knowledge, the ephemeral knowledge of the everyday, that's the actual glue of social interactions, why we want to annotate geography to improve this. And secondly, about how do we actually make this happen given the known problems around access to GIS data, copyright issues. I slightly disagree with Steve about the lack of need for high definition mapping. We've done pretty extensive trials and tests, and when you actually give people the opportunity to annotate within 1 meter square, they get very, very excited about it, and a whole new set of ideas about what they could do with it originate. So I just only slightly disagree with you there to say that high definition mapping is also very desirable to the general public, but they don't really have any real uses for it yet. So we've been building this software platform over the past couple of years to actually put our ideas into practice and give people the opportunity to really do this. As a result of this, we did have to dance with the devil, so to speak, in that we had to go and get GIS data from the Ordnance Survey, because previously all of the R&D projects in this area, especially the locative media type of projects, were obsessed with the idea of building GPS chips into everything. But longitude and latitude is not a human readable location or place format, and all of our research building in ethnography and anthropological work, as well as the kind of creative practices that we use to understand more about how people relate to place. This is the key thing. People relate to places, not to locations. Locations tend to be specified as a set of geographic points. People don't really think like that. And everyone has a slightly different idea about what a place is, where the boundaries are. And as we've seen, the ever-shifting boundaries of the electoral wards present lots of problems both for central and local government as well as for voters, so it's never entirely sure which ward one is in and how much relevance that really has. So we decided that we needed to have street names. It was absolutely important for people to and street addresses for them to be able to work out where they were, not only from a technical point of view but also from the visible world around them. There's no point having a purely technical system. We don't live purely in the virtual world. We're very physical beings. We read street signs. We talk to people. We know that certain shops have the address written on them. These are all very important location positioning pointers that we have in the world around us. So we've been trying to build systems that don't lock anybody into having to have a GPS chip, which are still very expensive for the average person. But the point was, the idea of this is if people are, in addition to the kinds of geographic information held by companies, local government authorities, central government agencies, if people are able to embed what they know about the place, then you get over this problem of the trust. Because people are used to fudging things. They're used to a little bit of information being inaccurate if they can change it. If they can say, ha, I know that's wrong, I'm going to change it. This is the problem with the system that we have in the UK. We have a secrecy and a control system of government. It's always been that way. The Freedom of Information Act is the first time this has been addressed. The Americans don't have that exact same governmental structure, but we do. Everything is secret here for as long as possible. And the OS is no distinction from this. The history of how they came into being, how they've operated, and how they've recently been semi-privatized in the most obscure and very difficult to understand way is a real problem. And actually trying to understand how the OS actually generates its revenue is also very complex. I recently downloaded their accounts for last year, and there's a huge slice of just sales revenue, which doesn't break down how much is public sector, how much is private sector. And I would like to know that. I think that would be very important, especially as 13% of their revenue comes from the National Interest Mapping Agreement, which they don't tell anybody about. This was very, I had to dig really deep into the accounts to discover just how much comes from the National Interest Funding Agreement. So I think the idea, it's very clear to us that the more that people are able to interact with information, to embed their own, to error correct, if you like, the official data that's out there, the richer an environment we will have, and our research has kind of indicated this. So the second thing is, how do we actually start to build these systems? The way we did it was by a kind of fudge with the OS that, because the research work we were doing was valuable to them, they gave us a free developer license and overlooked the fact that we completely break Crown copyright, because it's in their interest to learn how the public make use of this data. They specifically want that, so we were able to get some kind of working agreement around that. But it's not going to work forever. It's not going to work for anybody else. And one of our, as a research group, one of our points is we want to influence public policy. So for us, we have just written an adaptation of the Creative Commons license for the OS as part of a new working agreement that we're in the process of developing with them, and we're attempting to get them to at least adopt some form of sharing of data for free to non-profit, non-commercial projects. Obviously it becomes a basic license that others who wish to use this for non-profit, non-commercial uses can use. It doesn't solve every problem, but it at least makes something possible where at the moment really nothing is available at all. So the way I'd like to wrap that up is I do think that there is a lobbying case to be made to the current shareholder of the trading fund that is the Altman Survey, which is the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister. I think it behoves us as people interested in this area to actually clarify the situation and engage this as a policy objective to look at opening up access to GIS data, because it will actually improve the commercial and economic prospects of the OS. As we all know, the more that people are able to go out and experiment with things, the people who have business minds, the opportunities, and then it's up to them to go and raise the venture capital to build the profit-making ventures on top of that. But this is data that has been collected over several hundred years now. It's been contributed to by large numbers of people, not just those in the pay of the government. And I think we have an opportunity now to do something that is very inclusive, but actually increases the public wealth without contravening the OS's ability to make revenue and to be a profit-making organisation. And I think we need to find some various different ways to do that. And I'm sure they won't suit absolutely everybody, but as I'm sure some people will agree, the more opportunities we have to engage in dialogue, the better. So if you'd like to know more about our project, I have some postcards. And just to say, we will be releasing the next version of Urban Tapestries in June to coincide with Architecture Week.
Thanks. very much, and a link will go up to that from the site that I'll post later, the link to summarise this meeting. The next person to speak is Joe Walsh, and she needs an introduction.
So I'll keep this very short and sweet. So I'm here principally because I'm an open source software developer, and so in that mode I'll scratch my own itches, I'll follow my nose, I'll kind of pursue this technocratic imperative. And so why open source GIS has taken off quite a lot in the last few years are for entirely pragmatic reasons, are partly to do with the opening up of the GPS spectrum for civilian use in 2000, and are partly just to do with the increase in bandwidth and storage that's available to common or garden desktop users. So this has put us in a situation pretty much for the first time where free software has had this body of data to be tested against, has matured and developed so that there are a whole suite of open source GIS products, most of which are all based on this sort of universal conversion libraries written by this one brilliant guy, Frank Warmerdam. So for the first time, pretty much over the last year or two, it's been possible for ordinary desktop and web users to do quite sophisticated GIS with entirely free or very cheap software. So the situation, how this impacts on the licensing situation, which I think Roger will talk about in a bit more depth, the idea that a cost recovery policy for geographic data is sustainable when only a very small percentage of the population with business interests can afford to buy the software in the first place. ESRIs, ARC products are very expensive per seat, per CPU licenses. But when there is a situation when a broader swathe of the population can potentially have access to the software and can build these applications that define my local, the annotation, the correction, the whole wiki nature panorama of geo applications that we've seen outlined, then suddenly the cost recovery policy gets brought into question a bit more. So as a as an open source software hacker, I was lucky enough to get roped into writing a book with Skylar and our friend Rich called Mapping Hacks. It's like 100 little recipes, tips and tricks for things you can do on the web or on your desktop with public domain sources of GIS data. So as a result, pretty much 85% of the hacks in Mapping Hacks start off, first download this data source from your local government website, your state-funded government website. And most of the work we've done, it's an American publisher, so this isn't really a problem for them, but most of the work we've done has been with public domain sources published by NASA, the Landsat data, the SRCM data, and trying to use that to help contribute to these OpenStreetMap projects, to use that as a basis for community wireless network planning has been my main use case, and then for location-based services that can run on top of community wireless networks. So as an open source hacker in this debate, I feel there is a polarization, and perhaps Roger will go into this in a bit more depth, and it's the key point of his writings that I've seen, that there is a kind of polarization in this whole debate between the information wants to be free camp, in which I very firmly am, as a having experienced the economic and social and technical value of open source as regards software, and then a more hardline accuracy and currency must have a cost recovery policy. And the polarization between these two different ends of the debate is unhelpful, is unrealistic. And so I would like to be able to find a middle way, and that seems to be very much something that Giles is outlining in their Creative Commons-esque approach to the OS. And it's something that has a strong precedent now in the licensing of government-funded data in the UK, particularly BBC and Channel 4 have just launched this Creative Archive project, which is based on the Creative Commons license, which in turn derives a lot of its motivation from the GPL, the Classic Free Software License. So that's most of what I wanted to say. But thank you very much for being dragged along here, and I appreciate it.
I'm sorry.
Here we go.
We'll start off with just an observation. Where is the pagan seahorse there? People looked at that for hours and never saw the baby seahorse on the father's pill. Location-based geographic information. Right. I've been asked a lot tonight to talk about some of the policy issues that have been touched on in earlier presentations. In fact, I heard a comment earlier this evening saying that most of the technology is either resolved or is being resolved, or a lot of open source technology is now available to resolve it, and the problems that are left tend to be policy related to getting access to information, both for personal use or one-off use and then for exploitation and use. I've been looking at this area for far longer than I wish to admit now, since at least 1992 when I worked at the European Commission. I left in 99. One of the slides later is from the Vice Chancellor of my university, where I'm a part-time PhD research student, David Ryan, who many of you may remember as having been head of Oregon Survey for 7 years. So no, I didn't end up there by mistake. A lot of what we've heard about tonight is maps. It has to do with maps and mapping. And earlier we had a discussion about not so much mapping, but databases, actually capturing GPS points and then logging attributes against those. So this is a good coffee shop, but basically it's just a GPS point. And until you start to plot that somehow, you know, how is that used by the average human being, all the way a computer might be able to use it. We do some work. I do quite a bit of work in the coastal marine community now. My original training was in ocean engineering, where we have nautical charts playing a huge part, especially electronic nautical charts. We have digital databases covered by different IPR than copyright. You have the new Database Protection Act. We have imagery. We have all sorts of imagery. We have satellite imagery, aerial imagery, even things that you take yourselves. One of our coastal projects was a professor up at Aberdeen taking a very large model airplane, slinging a small digital video camera under it, and doing complete beach mapping using a model airplane with a video camera. Worked perfectly. Cost next to nothing. The other powers in the industry weren't too keen on this, and they didn't see this as being professional in some way. But you know, there's all sorts of ways to capture stuff. Then we have geospatial information products, other than just maps, leading into location-based services. All the concepts relating to location-based services, privacy aspects of location-based services. We had a conference about a year ago now out in Bristol, and I spoke on the ethics of location-based services. Is it okay that people know where you are all the time if they want to? So basically we're talking about any data. I'm talking about any data to which you can attach a location attribute, not simply a topographic map or just a boundary, but any sort of data. We never seem to question anything about data coming from commercial sources. Companies are formed to make profits. If the directors of companies don't make profits, the shareholders can have them put in jail. They can certainly have them fired from their positions. So the real discussion comes down basically to geodata collected by government. In other words, local government, national government, or in the case of a lot of the work coming out of the European Union, it's regional government, pan-European, where you are required to collect data to a certain standard so that it can be used in a harmonized way across the whole of Europe. And that has led to the big drive of this Inspire initiative, which I'll talk about just in a few minutes. And then we've heard tonight about, you know, privately created geodata. Now, what is the role of this? Do people want to claim some sort of intellectual property in this later? Will they physically put this in the public domain, which is an act, it's something you do. It means it is completely open for anybody else to do anything they want with it, include resell if they want to. Most people don't, because if it's in the public domain, anybody else can get it as well. So we're looking at all different types of geodata used by different types of organizations and created by different types of organizations, and they're governed by different types of regulations, both at the national level and at the international level, certainly at the pan-European level. We started looking at, I was at the commission in 92 when we started looking at GI, geographic information, as part of the Information Market Policy Actions Program, IMPACT. And then later in 94, America launched the big NSDI initiative through the presidential executive order in April 94. So we're now 11 years on from that. And everyone started saying, oh, look, everything's so wonderful in America. We have this huge base of free information. We use it to grow the size of the economy. 3, weather data, because I consider weather data to be geographic as much as anything else, i.e. it's something that has a location attribute. And we have access to this guaranteed by the Freedom of Information Act. And it's not something that was ever in the Constitution or in the Bill of Rights. It's actually just simply an act of Congress saying you have access to this, and it is updated from time to time as the access changes. But there are also major exceptions to what is free in America. One of the examples, which I'll mention now a little bit later, was the Earth observation satellite data. It has always been freely available in America, up until a few years ago when they decided to sell Landsat data. And immediately, use of Landsat data dropped about 90%. So they decided it wasn't a good idea to sell Landsat 5, and they actually made it free again. The same organization had a satellite called EO-1, Earth Observation 1, big environmental satellite, launched originally by NASA, who ran out of money to operate it. So they convinced NOAA to operate it, the National Oceanographic and Aeronautic Administration. They ran it for a while, so they ran out of money. It cost about $15 to $20 million a year just to monitor a satellite once it's been launched. Forget what it costs to build and get it up there. These are big expenses. So they passed it to U.S. Geological Survey. U.S. Geological Survey only took it on the basis that they were able to sell the data. And they sell the data for $2,800 a tile. They sell it for full commercial recovery rate for the cost of maintaining that satellite up in space. They get around it by redeclaring the EO-1 satellite as an experimental satellite. It's one of the 14 exceptions. Experimental data doesn't have to be made freely available under the FOI. So there's ways to get around some of these things. In the UK, we've had government policies differ depending on the type of agency and the source of their income. We had an activity started here, when did the click use and all this, about 99? Changes here. There were changes to the way people accessed information coming through HMSO with the development of quick use licenses to have easier access to Crown copyright protected information. And we tend to hear a lot about the trading fund status of OSGB and the charging for data. People do tend to forget that there are something like 17 trading funds in this country. The Royal Mint was the first about 30 years ago, I believe. It is a commercial operation. It has to recover its costs. The Met Office and the Hydrographic Office are also major trading funds who have to recover their costs, and they must pay their own way. And this is not a decision of the survey, this is a decision of the UK government. It's a Treasury decision to do this. People also sometimes forget that you're not buying data from these organizations, whether it's the Met Office, Hydrographic Office, or OSGB, you're licensing it for a specific use in a specific way. And this is where I've seen so many projects that were funded by the Commission over the years. An entire 2 or 3 million euro project would take place, perhaps using data not just from OS, but from other mapping agencies in Europe or other data suppliers. They only had access to this data for the period of the research. They had no right to use it later on. And a lot of the research they completed was therefore useless later on because nobody else could use the systems they developed. They don't think about this. And it probably affects 20 to 25% of the projects in the geospatial area that I've seen in reviewing maybe 50, 60 projects of the Commission over 15 years. Here in the UK, we have local authorities. Don't forget, in America, local data and government data is not covered by the Freedom of Information Act. The Freedom of Information Act only applies to federal data or data collected using federal funding. The state of Michigan does not have to make its data freely available. 5 states in America have laws requiring that they sell their data, or at least that they sell their GIS services. It's state law that they must sell it to try to recover money. It's not freely available. What's happened in the states is the quality of data deteriorated. Something like about half of the USGS database is more than 25 years out of date. They launched the project to try to get the states and the counties to bring their more current, more accurate, large-scale data back into the national remit. And that has not been effective. It's not working. There was a report from the Office of Management and Budget just within the last 2 months saying that, okay, it's ongoing, but because we can't force these people to do this, it's only those who seem to have any extra resources who are doing it. Well, how many people in local government have any extra resources in their country? Other departments, like the Environment Agency in this country and throughout Europe, are required to make data freely available. partly because of EU directives, the access to environmental data, let's talk about that. Perhaps under the new EC directive on public sector information, other public agencies will be required to make their data more readily available. Don't forget that the EC directive on public sector information is not an access directive, it's an exploitation directive. That's in the title. It's for exploiting public sector information, not just having access to it. You can use it. And then we have the Aarhus Convention on Access to Environmental Data and data used for public participation in justice decisions. That is also now the focus of two EC directives, again, dealing with access to information, public information. So what's so bad about cost recovery? Basically, people say the taxpayer is already paid. But in the case of the trading funds, because they sell their data, are not getting any money from the Treasury. In some cases, they're getting some funds for what, you know, the national interest mapping in the case of OFGB, but the bulk of the money is still coming from sales. So whether you believe in that or not, the point is they're not using taxpayers' funds from that point of view. They're actually selling data, and the data is being bought by those who want it and are willing to pay for it. There's a cost to collect the revenue. There are sales and marketing staff costs. There are protecting the revenue sources costs. I gave a seminar, it must be about 1997 or 8, down at the OS, on a project we were doing at the commission called Informatica. It had to do with the digital rights monitoring systems. And I found out then exactly how big the size of the legal staff was at that time. This was going 8 years ago now, so I won't use any figures today, but there was quite a large legal staff involved simply to protect the copyright, basically protect the revenue stream. And these are high costs, and they're also difficult to find out about. We've already heard how difficult it is to get information on exactly how much is spent on what if you want to hold somebody to account. But that's another, again, it's another issue. Information economics. Most of the studies, and you can point to dozens of studies, well, say a dozen studies in this area, say the greatest value for information generally comes from its widest use, whether that's by the citizens or by value adders or by government. Obviously, the more you can use data which is not consumed in its use, which makes it a very unique product in the world, then the more value it should have. But then you get on to other questions on the quality of the data, the value of the data. Is it fit for purpose? If you make a mistake, if the data has an error in it and you crash your car, can you sue somebody? There's lots of side issues on access to data from different sources. And it's alleged that citizens who have free access to all government held data are better citizens. This is part of the, I say alleged, but it depends on which study you read. We're all being encouraged to become part of the e-government society. E-governance is the key of the commission now in every program they do. And you can't be part of an e-governance society unless you have access to information and make decisions. Now, sorry for the size of this one, it's a very busy slide. Should we ever charge the public sector GI? First of all, whether you charge for it or control access to it in some way, even public sector GI, it helps you get feedback as to how it's being used. The European Space Agency policy is, as a researcher, you can have access to their data. EnviSat is one of the most sophisticated satellites ever built, if you want an environmental satellite, with something like 12 sensors on it. But you have to sign a policy, you have to sign a contract with them, where you have to use it. You can't just get the data and do nothing with it. If you haven't used it in 6 months, you lose the right to have any more of it. And if you add value to it and use it to do an environmental research project, everything you produce also is owned by ESA for the next 18 months from the time your project finishes. And they can make it freely available if they want to. At the end of 18 months, they rescind any IPR on what you've got. So they basically say, okay, we spent billions to get this thing up here. We're spending hundreds of millions to run it. You can have it, but you have to show that you're using it. And if you do something interesting with it, we want to know about it, and we want to have access to it for a short period of time. It's a bit of a cut-down version between 17-year patenting, the patent law on access to your own ideas versus a bit of copyright. Then there's an example in New Zealand. 2 years ago, New Zealand made the entire survey database for the whole of New Zealand, the raw data, a 30 gigabyte tape. All right, this is the days before we had 120 gigabyte disk drives. The 30 gig DAC tape available for the price of reproduction, which was 200 New Zealand dollars, about 80 pounds. They set up 12 distributors to sell this, and they expected a big run. People were going to really desperately want this. This is the raw update, and we produced raw survey data for New Zealand. 7 copies were distributed in the first year. What do you do with a 30 gig DAC tape if you're a citizen? What do you do if you're Greenpeace? I mean, you need specialists to even read this stuff. So the problem was, the raw data doesn't help. It's got to be processed in some way. It's got to be made usable by people. Then you can talk about trying to make it more available. Charging conveys power to the consumer. You have consumer rights if you pay for something. Whether you can exercise them or not depends upon how well protected your vendor might be under other regulations. Charging does reduce the tax load of the Treasury in this country. But if OS operates at 120 million pounds a year and we're saving that somehow from the tax base to generate a benefit of underpinning 100 billion pounds in the economy, which are in reports produced on behalf of OS, and used to help underpin its status, well, that's only 0.1%, 0.1%. So maybe government could change its mind and decide to pay OS 120 million anyway, if it's really this valuable to the whole UK economy. Is it more ethical that all taxpayers should pay for government GI if only some of us use it? I mean, road traffic hauliers, the transport companies use GI much more than you or I will. We may go on a map quest or even buy an ordnance survey map and go somewhere, but we're not big users compared to other people. So there's different classes of users who get different benefits. And how do you cover this if the taxpayer is paying in general? If users do contribute something to the cost of that GI, in the case of local government especially, who collect a lot of data that is affected by OS, then does government respond to their needs any better than it did before, if it wasn't in a charging position? The point is, there's lots of different ways of charging. Now, this slide comes from a former director of OS, my erstwhile vice chancellor at City University, and that was when he was in charge, not when I was in charge. The slide he used a month ago at a transport meeting here in London, looking at this is OSGV paying its own way. And one thing you'll notice right away, the very end arrow there on the right-hand side where it ends when David Ryan was in charge of OS, 1999, that's also when OS became a trading fund. They weren't a trading fund before then. They've been selling data forever. I mean, government agencies sell data. Environment Agency reports from 15 years ago, if you tried to get something from the Environment Agency, they might charge you £12 for the report. They have been covering their costs, recovering costs, just not recovering full market value. It was after 99 that they were set these targets for return on investment and covering all their costs, with the exception of the bit that is paid under the National Service Agreement. So it's not something new that OS charges for data, or that the Met Office, or that the Hydrographic Office charges for data. So what's been the impact of that so far? Basically, OS and the Hydrographic Office, world leaders, and the Met Office, world leaders in their climate modeling and their information, part of the reason they claim to be able to do this is because they have the resources they need to do the job, and they're not dependent just on Treasury. And if push comes to shove, politician says, no, you can't have the money this year, then you stop your development program. In the States, USGS, federally funded, has a program to monitor water quality in the whole of America. 2 years running, they were going to cancel that entire program because the federal government was not going to give them the $18 to $20 million a year it took to monitor freshwater quality in America. You can't get, a pound out of a 50 pence piece. You've got to have the money. So they were just going to cancel freshwater quality monitoring. Well, it made a big enough stink in the national press that the government finally kicked in and gave them the money. They have to fight that every year, keep getting this sort of benefit of that. And you'd think monitoring freshwater quality to a whole nation is a pretty important thing to do. Convince that to a politician sitting in Washington or a politician sitting here in London. Then you get friction. This is a problem where the environmental agency is required under the current directive, which became the law here in February 2005, to provide free access to environmental data. And the environmental data is an attribute that is displayed on a location. I mean, where a pollution spot occurs, the type of pollution, the concentration, the chemical, the future toxicity, whatever, these are all attributes of environmental data, which are displayed on a location. Now, if somebody controls the IPR on the location side of that, and somebody else doesn't worry about IPR control, strong IPR control on the attribute side, this is where the conflict arises. And this is what's going to be happening more and more as we start to introduce the PSI directive in this country later on. Let's not go on this. This is, again, it's more about, it's not just the Environment Agency. There also is our Vice Chancellor is also head of the National Statistical Board now, which is looking at providing statistical information freely available, which it is. And then the minute you try to map it onto an OS or some other copyrighted map, then you have frictional problems coming in. And then you have businesses stepping in using things in different ways. So, how does the public benefit most? You've got a trading fund, we've got 17 trading funds in this country. They generate about $350 million per annum in funds, which don't come on the tax burden, on the tax load, so your taxes aren't covering these. Versus you might have much wider use of the government data if it was delivered directly by government for lower prices and especially for reuse. And this is where the PSI directive would come in. Really, it's probably going to end up being something in between. We already have in-between business models going on. What we don't have is enough information on what all these models are, what their real impact is, and how they affect different societies. The disbenefits are, we have the government agencies have these different data access policies. And so it's difficult for not only a citizen, but for a researcher, for a company to know how are they supposed to operate when the whole point of distributed internet, distributed software, open source tools to do this is to bring all these lovely data sources together to get whole new rounds of information and knowledge, except you're going to be hamstrung by the policies involved, because there are different policies coming from different places. The main directives are the Directive on Access to Environmental Data, which has already been made into law in the UK February this year. We have the PSI directive, this is Public Sector Information Exploitation, 1st July of this year. We have the Inspire directive, which if it were to go through in any format, this would relate specifically to geospatial information, will become law sometime, well, it will become a directive sometime in 2006. It probably wouldn't become law, since it's usually a two-year, two-and-a-half-year hiatus until 2007 or even 2008. And there are other directives dealing with e-government, directives dealing with telecommunications privacy, directives dealing with e-commerce. There's a whole range of directives that are already being translated into national law in the member states that affect what you can do with data and information and maps. They're products. They're covered by other law as well. So looking at the real debate, we have this charge versus non-charge debate. It seems to be very polarized, and we've been looking at this, apart from my other co-director, Mike Blakemore and I, for a number of years now, and what we're trying to do is depolarize the debate by looking at real evidence-based answers. There isn't maybe one answer, but we're looking at the different aspects of charging versus non-charging. There are goods and bads in both cases. In an ideal world, each society would make up its own decision based on its information culture, based on its government culture. There's never going to be one size fits all. There just isn't. There isn't today, and I can't see it happening in the future. So some of you talking today think you've solved some of this puzzle because we've got open source software coming in, we've got people working on doing new deals with ordnance surveying, new types of maps and getting its data. And you know the answers. It would be really good if you could talk to us later, because if you know the answers, I want to hear about it. Tony Hancock said, well, don't have a wine gun. That's all the thanks you're going to get at the end of the day. But the rest of the world will be really happy to hear about it.
We were over time to have two very quick presentations, but because we're running slightly late, we will do them, but maybe we put on the people who can talk to the individuals rather while we're having wine and so on, because we'd be better to have the questions, I think, now, or some of the presentations for us in mind. So if anyone has any questions for the panel, please put up your hand now.
I do think high access data is great.
That's just to give Steve the money and he'll do it for you.
Okay.
He does a really good
job.
The man
of the
machine.
So it's just
next
one.
It is
actually possible for people.
It's cheaper than
some of the
quicks.
Yeah.
To get
out,
get
them
from
GPS,
download the GPS.
You can hire a car for 2 days with your laptop and buy a GPS for that.
What a deal.
I'll take that for one.
Yeah, Rob, you said that all the trading funds comes to $350 million. So how does that break down for the OS? How much
is it? OS last year, OS was about $118 million.
Okay, and how much
of their operating budget is geared to sales and all the other stuff. And
that's where it's more difficult. That's where it's more difficult.
They don't declare that in their accounts. They hide a lot in the general operating accounts.
My name is Arthur. I'm actually from the Ordnance Survey. I'm the director of the Ordnance Survey. We just want to debate so far. I think that's a very well balanced and fascinating point. Around that specific point, I'd say probably between 4% and 6% overall operating budget for the sales and marketing. The vast majority is in data capture. So we have got two aeroplanes with digital cameras in them. We have 350 surveyors distributed around the country with a £20,000 GPS system in the back, wandering around. That's where most of the money goes.
Well, that's good. And would any of that start going into the pool each year, just so it's kind of official? I mean, we're very privileged to have an unofficial. These unofficial data, will it be going into more detailed breakdown at all, do you think? That would be fascinating to actually see it kind of. If it's just kind of off the record, as it were.
Yeah, it is off the record. That's my best guess. I do see the account in more detail than
you see. The public
I can't give that information out.
Yeah.
I think plenty of time goes on, you can see more detail in their accounts. There are other legislative reasons that you need to put more detail in their accounts. That will become more apparent. So, in any way, it's no different for any other commercial company or any other commercial company who has this account. We're not going to find it.
Well, then,
sorry, first time, it's not true, though, but that 150 million pounds in this year is money that's not borne by the taxpayer, because the money of your income, of course, comes from government.
That's a good point. You get income from government, there's an interest, which is probably 20% of our overall revenue. Then there's a proportion, and it's probably more than half of our revenue that comes from central and local government. So then if you compare that to many other IT companies that sell, no one of their revenue comes from
the local government. You talk about ESRI
and the GIS vendor, the vast majority of their sales comes
from
the local government. Okay, anyone else? Of course, that's what I mean. So basically, yep. If you could make a case that sort of opening up the data would make you more than £100 million, it seems you're just getting the scope of things that are really small now, like you're making a fund between the different GIS economy.
Well, we say that. Well, we started, Professor Blake, Mike Latemore and I, one of my co-directors in IPRA, we're looking right now at how much goes into the data products, the geospatial data products and services created in America, where it's supposed to be so easy because of the FOI, because so much is available for free. About the only thing that's really useful, speaking of generality, is, let's say, the Tiger files, which are done by the Census Bureau as far as boundaries and addresses and things, which are now being, only in the last year, we just found a reference a month or so ago, there is now a continuous update program being funded by the U.S. government on behalf of the Census Bureau to actually keep their stuff going, and a whole range of companies have won pieces of this action to try to keep the target files more up to date than they used to be. And they used to be updated about, once every 10 years or so, around census time. But other data sources, as I say, if you go to a lot of the so-called free data sources, except for the satellite imagery, which is generally available in free America, some of this stuff is 27 years old. I mean, I was quoting an article in Science Magazine a year and a half ago, by the head of the program at U.S. Geological Survey, who was trying to run this new program to get new data in, and she quoted 27-year-old data for 50% of the database. So there is no equivalent to OS in the U.S. And the U.S. Geological Survey does lots of other things as well. It's involved in water quality monitoring, you name it. But it's the closest they have to a mapping agency. So what we're trying to find out is from those companies that actually create data products and services that make this huge expanding market in geospatial products and services in America, how much are they spending on collecting that data? If they're not getting it from government,
because the data is so far out of date. A, they're probably buying it in from local government and state governments who are collecting high quality, accurate, large scale data because they have to manage their environment just like everybody else in the world does. But they're not required to make it freely available. Some of them may, but I can quote states, at least five states where the policy is to sell it. Their state law talks about selling it.
So which states? I'm sorry, you're asking which states? Which?
Well, the ones like Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee are the three that I remember because I've been in touch with their data, GIS data managers. The other two are, they tend to be in the Midwest at the moment. And also, I will say also, they don't necessarily enforce it too strongly in two of those states. It's law because that's what the politicians wanted to get, you know, data back. But the people who actually aren't trying to enforce that law aren't doing it that strong.
I had just one question on that, which was, is there an issue that the kind of what I would call the GPL type approach to licensing? GPL being the people who took the data would have to give back. Because an issue is, this issue that here you're suggesting, now the one way of keeping data up to date perhaps is if people who are going to go and use it have to contribute back. Because maybe an issue here is like you could go and take it, improve it, and have no incentive to give back. For the basis on which you build, and would that be for maintaining the data better, perhaps, you know, but in a commons more of the situation rather than simply just.
Yeah, that would be one way of doing it, and that is exactly the policy of the European Space Agency. You get their data basically for free. I mean, €240 a tile or something, which is a tenth of the commercial price. But you have to use it, means you're adding value to it, and you have to make it available back to them for 18 months, and they can do what they want with it, including make it really available to the whole world. It's easy to deal with data. And after that, you're also semi-protected. It's one of these balance models, because at the end of that 18 months, the IPR is yours again.
Okay.
Well, just to add, I think Roger elucidated this very well, but it's also, and bringing up that it's not just the OS, that there are many trading funds, and a lot of the data is nested between them. And for instance, we've discovered, as I'm sure Ed would be able to explain much better than I do, that the OS doesn't even own all of the data it uses. For instance, all of the street names, street addresses and postcodes are post office data, and the post office is another kind of trading fund, which is even more bizarre. And so it's very, you can't just say, it's a political lobbying, and it is an issue of citizens engaging with government, businesses engaging with government. It's not just sort of a question of writing on about one particular agency or two or three particular agencies. And this is why I think, from my point of view, this idea of a joined-up approach, that yes, you know, activism models are very, very good because they give incentive. Sort of the way we're doing, which is sort of sneaking in the back door, is very good. But also just actually sort of making a broad public debate about this, because these are very important issues, and they will affect us in our everyday life more and more and more over the next generation.
Tom, and then
Tom. I'm Tom Spander, I'm from Lush. The idea that this is not simply charging, that non-charging is very, very important, but on the non-charging, there's two huge divisions. There's the question of all the urban service, be this type of organisation that doesn't charge at all. It seems to be transfer. And then there's a much more limited question, pertinent probably to more people in this room, but is there any possibility of a licence for non-commercial use? And then that is my question. Is there any possibility of a licence for non-commercial use?
What's the right
to me then, is it?
I'm glad you came tonight, Ed.
I think in the short term, that's unwise. Yeah. Now let me explain some of the rationale behind that. You know, a lot of our cost is to maintain very, very detailed mapping. There's essentially inter accuracy between failure model and my hand. That's the vast majority of our cost goes into maintaining that database. And it's constantly changing. And this much GPS are actually having to make us changing more frequently, because now wandering around with the GPS you can see the inaccuracy in our data where previously it didn't matter. So actually we've gone around in over the past 5 years, we've resurveyed literally the whole country taking into account and including the accuracy of GPS. So there's a huge cost associated with that. But I think, and what I'm gathering from this is there is a different type of data that is more valuable to the citizen. It isn't that really detailed mapping, it is street mapping, it is having points of interest, whatever that is. But I think the citizen would agree, in the same way that Jay talks about the open source movement, that I think is one of the best ways that data can be created. And that might sound strange maybe more so, this is my own personal view here, not to be moving further. But I think there is a potential for a smaller scale data, less detailed, that is more appropriate for wider general use, being developed in different ways. So that's not something that I think we will necessarily do in the short term, and we will have great difficulties in making that very detailed mapping that we need to charge the users or the capture, making that available to non-profit organisations. I don't think many of you will use it, if I go back to New Zealand example. It's very detailed, it will take tens of terabytes to store all the information.
But would you be able to give, is it not, does the OSRA not possess data at less resolution? You know, could not have a clear idea. For example, just to give an example, I heard yesterday to do with content, was there's a guy called Rick Pellinger who has an archive of film, and he makes a lot of his films, these kind of advertising stuff, I mean, available for free. But at the same time, if you want the really high quality stuff, you don't want to get off the website or whatever compression, they will sell it. And in fact, they find they make more revenue by giving out a low-level res and then people using it and coming up with ideas. I mean, there's not something that would actually generate more revenue for you on the show if you give out something in the lower tier and then cream off the high-quality users.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a gap. The current rules that we don't consider would mean for a medium-scale, street-level data set that would be used to the general public for many, many users. Our focus largely is on that large scale, very detailed mapping. And we use that to derive other products, but they tend to be less useful. They're mapping products, they're cartographic products that are pictures of maps. Now the stuff that you get up in multi-map or in street map, but it is a picture. You're confused about understanding. What we need is extra information, very much in the same way that it's easily collected.
The Global Mapping Project, the international project, is trying to do 1 to 1 million for the whole world, which Eurogeographics is covering the European region. They're doing the European version of the global map. Is OS 1 to 1 million scale data in that or not?
We're going to produce a new data set to fill the needs for that European map.
But that is freely available for non-commercial purposes, if I remember reading the IPR.
Yeah,
that's 1 to 1 million. So, I mean, that sort of data is coming along, which is of use to some people for some regional planning purposes, but not like finding the next star. Not finding the next star.
I wanted to mention that. The approach that Steve's taking and our contributions to it, and Nick's contributions to it, Richard's to be soon, we're mapping what we can see, but there are a lot of things that we can't see that are very important to have mapped, and the main one of these is political boundaries, is war boundaries, and hopefully Chris will have a chance to talk about this in a few moments, and what they're doing with My Society on building political participation applications. And we just can't, well, in theory, we probably could find text descriptions of council war boundaries and walk around them with GPS units, but there are some data sources which are invisible in the world.
And they reproduce the war boundary map. When we got them back, they have a lot of copyright on them. We found them in the case on them. And when they have then a very good dialogue with all the surveys to rectify the inaccuracy of the map, and let them do evaluated things that they can watch for the conversation. But my understanding was, why would we suddenly become copyright when we initially actually produced the data set for the war disease, and that was.
But it's another perfect example of the problem, because we have multiple policies in this country and other countries, that the minute you try to mix things, even if it's something like that, it's difficult.
There are so many spikes in the pie and by different people, and all gets easier.
I think there are, just to jump in very quickly and answer some of Ed's questions about usage, there are some very clear uses from which the Ordnance Survey can derive direct data. For instance, one of the things we've been focusing on in building the Urban Tapestries platform is the ability for people to map physical phenomena. For instance, disabled people, rather as a part of the Disability Act over the next long period of time, unspecified, all local authorities are going to have to map every aspect of physical access into all of their buildings. How the hell are they going to do it? Where are the surveyors? If there was an ability for people with disabilities to map the physical issues that they encountered, because the fundamental GIS data was available to them to be able to do it, then everyone would benefit. The OS would then benefit because it would know more about what does it need to map. Does it need to map the height of the curb? And we've had these conversations with the R&I group, and there is a lot of potential learning that would be of immense benefit. What we need to do is to articulate this, and articulate this at a policy level that will free up the OS's ability to act, because unfortunately the handcuff is the handcuff of governments, not commercial activity. I mean, you can't compete with anybody. You're prohibited by law to compete.
That's another issue that we have, making information available under different terms, the under competition law. If I start company X, so much per gigabyte of data, I have to charge company Y or organization Z that same amount. That causes a huge number of agreed firms, because we have to manage quite a complex community of data and try to come up with licenses that are more specific to a particular type of use. But you know, that's another aspect that, you know, it's not about making. Competition law
and the question at the front here.
Yeah, as Joe said, if there is a chance, this is what I will touch on, this is your electroboundary data. One of the funny things about electroboundary data, which I will mention now, as we glance around, is that the source information is available. It is crown copyright, it's in statutory instruments, simply. It's in, with a couple of exceptions, specifically in England, many of the statutory instruments which sent electrobounties are stopped by mapping data which are produced by the transport field on the survey, which are not available for distribution. In other parts of the country, they are not prepared in exactly the same way. One of the most striking things about the open survey product for digital boundaries is that they can't quite keep up. Every time there is an issue with the open survey's boundaries product, it will be accessed. And that's very, very striking if you imagine the point of view of a local authority which has the duty and law to conduct an election. One of the other things that we discovered with cooperators like my society is that many local authorities get information on the back as well, and also many government agencies do. We know, for instance, that if you go to the House of Parliament website and type in your postcode, to find out which constituency you are in, you will very frequently get an incorrect answer because they replace the access. And this is to do with the phasing of updates, if it does. And this seems to me, there's a lot of this which I won't go into now, but this seems to be an area in which an open knowledge model could be quite useful, because in principle, all of the work that we're on the survey do in producing digital boundary data could be done by the source material is freely available. But there is no competitor at all. And so we have this funny situation where the data are so expensive, and in our view, it's mostly right, but it's still, there are still places where it goes wrong. Available only in one source, there's no other way that you can get hold of this. It's an extraordinary thing about the way the democracy is run at its most mechanical level.
Just
the issue
of
access,
we haven't learned when we try to make information available that the system can go on our website, just type in a postcode and find out where it's available. Postcode boundaries still follow all boundaries. And so if you put a postcode in, the centaur might lie in one ward, but your motivation might lie in another ward. And that's why we don't provide that information on our website. And it causes a big leak. It's a constant discussion of why we don't show it.
We just looking at the text of the press or the user help questions we get, we write to them, which is my source of service, because we've been constantly there as their senses. That source of error seems to be smaller than the apparent source of error where we give out accurate data that differs from the inaccurate data given out by our organizations.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to wrap up.
One question. There were some questions earlier from people in digital about how things will be better because of the new EC directives, one of which is already law, the Environmental Access Directive, and one which will become law in July, the PSI Directive, better in relation to charging. I would read from the directives themselves, the Access to Environmental Information Law, repealing this directive from 10 years ago, does state that one of the exceptions for which information doesn't have to be made available is intellectual property rights. And that's all the word, it just says intellectual property rights. So if you can claim IPR on it, you might be able not to make it accessible. Under charging, Article 5, public authorities may make a charge for supplying any environmental information, but such charge shall not exceed a reasonable amount. Paragraph 18, in particular cases where public authorities make available environmental information on a commercial basis, and which is necessary in order to guarantee the continuation of collecting and publishing such information, a market-based charge is considered to be reasonable. So the directive itself isn't going to stop public agencies from charging for information. The same clause, the same Article 18 clause called Paragraph 14 occurs in the PSI directive, which would affect local government data, not just trading fund data or some other data. So when these directives were made, compromises had to be made. And one of the compromises has been, if you need to charge commercial price, and the price can include recovery of costs, creating the data, collating the data, disseminating the data, updating the data, blah, blah, it goes on. I mean, basically, it's the entire cost of running your operation if your main operation is collecting data. Under the PSI directive, you can charge for it.
Which will give us reason to more closely examine EU legislation. I'm sorry to not allow more questions, but A, we need to kick out here, and I've tried your patience long enough. Anyone with more questions, please come up and ask them. There's also going to be cases, there's going to be a fight now for this, so I even hope there's going to be discussion if some of you have joined, so that debate can take place in virtual space, perhaps, I hope.
Designated pub.
Designated pub, yes. I have either if you go up and right along. I'm not sure if
we need a map.
I identified it earlier, but that's not the pub we went to last time. Okay? Which was several miles in the wrong direction. So a big thing is we'll follow up. If you want to have some wine first while we're here, we have no mountain today. But while I sort that out, if you want to have some wine, and even if it's doing nothing more than one.
So, how are we going to see the presentation that we make?
Yes, okay, so, anyone got your URL? OpenKnowledgeFoundations.org /OKForum.
So is there no time, is there not 15 minutes now when those presenters who came?
I'd really like
to have some presentations.
If it's possible, that would be nice to see a person.
Absolutely. My view is that theoretically, I'm supposed to be out of the binary code. Is Gwen? I'm ready. I don't know. I want to finish this kind of vote, but would people like to hear these presentations quickly? Or would they like to ask?
Yes.
Okay, two very quick presentations. I try your patience. Which would be mine? Maybe I'll just show you alcohol while it's going on. Okay, let's get this.